Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Real Vision Daily Briefing, live without a net. I am joined today by Ed Harrison, getting the old band back together once again.
Good to see you, Billy Ray. How am I supposed to say it? Yeah.
Usually I'm the one
By the way, just so you know, Ash, I didn't tell you, but I got it here. Look good. That's what I'm supposed to be telling you. Looking good, Billy Ray.
Looking good, Lewis. Talking about looking good and looking bad, let's talk about what's happening in capital markets, in macro, in digital assets, the good, the bad, the ugly. It's been an eventful 24 hours.
Yeah, you know, I saw what you and Rao put together as an insert for the daily briefing that we had yesterday that Jack was running. I thought that was interesting. You know, I don't have a view just in terms of holding for the long term, hodling, if you will. But I think what Rao said yesterday made a lot of sense to me in terms of the price action. We were clearly in oversold territory. I would say once we got even to the 40,000 level, you know, we dipped down to where Bitcoin was cut in half. And it was clear that we were going to get a bounce. We did get a bounce. That bounce took us all the way to 42,000 today before we had some more regulatory headwinds in the form of the U.S. Treasury.
Yeah, absolutely. And let's just run through some of the numbers here to bring people up to speed. Currently, as we do this live here at about 4:17 Eastern time, Bitcoin trading at 40,442. And to review the events of the last 24 hours, I believe we had a sell-off of approximately 40%, and now Bitcoin up about 9%, recovering. You know, to your point, it seemed like a bit of a pile-on from U.S. Treasury coming on some news out of China. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. But, you know, obviously a lot of negative news, and it's interesting you talk about it being potentially oversold yesterday. You know, I try not to get too into the weeds on the technical side, but it certainly did feel like it was oversold based on some indicators, Fibonacci retracements and that sort of thing. But bigger picture, it's interesting to me that you get more bad news piling on today, and yet the price rises somewhat, almost 9%. That to me suggests that maybe that there is some consolidation. But look, we have to say it quite bluntly and quite directly. Crypto markets, Bitcoin, and other protocols. These are incredibly, incredibly volatile assets. So the next direction could be up, could be down. We know that, you know, as something like a billionaire jumping on Twitter maybe and tweeting something out has an influence on the price. So, you know, folks have to be careful.
Definitely. And, you know, I think there was one piece of news that Diego Perea, who seems to be a bit of a Bitcoin skeptic, crypto skeptic all around, said, and that's all about sizing. And, you know, obviously, if you're emotional about something, then that's a suggestion or that's a hint to you that you're probably not sized correctly. Because when you take the emotion out of it, then you can let the winners ride. I saw something actually that Whitney Tilson wrote earlier today, and he was talking about speculation versus buying and holding. He was talking about letting your winners run. You know, if you are a buy and holder and you're an investor for the longer term, you want to let your winners run. But if you're purely speculating, you have no attachment to the asset or the asset class, then obviously, you know, when the going gets tough, you want to cut your losses short because you're speculating. You there's not a fundamental position. That's when you want to cut it short. So I thought that was a good distinction that he made when he was thinking about crypto, actually, in this particular case.
Yeah, I think so much there you said is spot on. I really enjoyed that conversation with Diego Perea. And as I said at the end, look, even if you don't fundamentally agree with Diego on his position on Bitcoin per se, there was an incredible amount of wisdom that he dispensed on things like position sizing, how to think about markets, the framework for thinking about risk, understanding emotions. It was a masterclass from someone who spent a lot of time on the sell side, even more time on the buy side, a very senior, very experienced person telling folks really the way markets work and what has worked for him. Look, the thing about markets is when you've been in them for a long time, particularly in the kinds of roles that Diego Perea has been in, you get whooped, you get beat up. And those lessons, when you make those mistakes, those costly mistakes, you feel them, they resonate with you, and you think through how you can maintain upside and limit downside. So I thought it was just an absolute masterclass. Again, even if you don't agree with his thesis on Bitcoin, a masterclass in investing and how to think about markets.
Definitely. Now, you know, let's make this a connection of the events of the day to the macro by talking about sort of the framework that you know, I'm thinking about in particular. I'm thinking about what's happening in the context of the interregnum. I think when you and I spoke last time, I probably posited that there's an interregnum period. We had the reflation trade in January and February. Bonds sold off during that period while even the most speculative of assets went up. Technology soared. And the whole concept was is that we were going to have reflation in the economy when it reopened, and that was going to be very positive for shares, particularly shares that are the growthiest of stocks. But you know, once we got to March and April, we entered sort of this interregnum, I would call it, and this is where we're waiting basically for the full reopening. We're in the midst of the full reopening now. It's just starting. We're just starting to get the data associated with the full reopening. And so it's causing a lot of gyrations. And what we've seen, I think, just from a macro lens perspective, is that we've seen bonds rally. They've been range bound in sort of the 150 to 160 level for US 10-year treasuries. And we've seen, while that's happened, a sell-off in the most speculative of stocks, the likes of Tesla, ARK Invest has seen their prices drop in their ETFs. And of course, Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies have taken it on the chin. I would say exactly for the same reasons is that you're seeing people reassess where we're going in terms of the growth paradigm. So when I see what happened yesterday, it was sort of a culmination of a lot of different things coming together. And then when we look at today and the price action, interestingly, for me, the thing that stands out as usual, since I'm a credit guy, is bonds. You know, the U.S. 10-year was down to 163.2. That's 3%. And when you look at the indices and how they perform today in equities, it was NASDAQ up 1.8%. It was S&P up 1%. Dow up 0.5%, exactly what you would think when you believe that we're still in a period in which the toggle is interest rates. So yeah, that's to me the background for everything that's coming together today.
Yeah, you just said there some extremely important points. Let's unpack it a little bit. Interregnum, if I remember correctly, it's the period in between kings. So it's this idea, or queens, that you have this period of transition between regimes. You have this transition between one period and the next. Obviously, the big picture here on U.S. Treasury yields, let's look at the 10-year yield, for example, just to unpack some of what you said, coming from about 50 basis points at August at the trough. Right now, as you said, one spot 63. But again, that's a little bit of a rollover in yield. And the points that you made really about, and break this down for folks, talking about the rotation trade between growth and value and what it means and how you're able to tease out that from the NASDAQ, S&P, and Dow relative positions.
Yeah, so what I see on a consistent basis is as yields go up or down more than 2 or 3 basis points, let's say 5 basis points as it was today, as an example, what you'll see is a change in the level of equities that is goes from the least sensitive to interest rates to the most sensitive. So the Dow is known as the lowest beta of the three indices. The S&P is sort of the normal beta. And then you have the highest beta index, which is the NASDAQ. And so when interest rates go down, then you would expect the NASDAQ to outperform relative to the Dow, relative to the S&P, relative to the Dow. And that's exactly what we've seen. And this is a trend that we see over and over, irrespective of whether we see gains or losses. It's that sort of in concert trading between bonds and stocks that tells you that the discount rate, which is the 10-year T-bond, that's really a toggle for how people are starting to think about the economy.
Yeah, such an interesting point. Ed, I'm sure you probably know the questions are already rolling in. Let's hit a couple of these because they're across the board and, as always, very insightful and interesting questions. The first question comes to us, something that we were just talking about, Ed, off camera, from Ricky Martignetti. Could Ash and Ed cover China's comments this week on crypto and why they feel there was a flash crash yesterday, which has rebounded very quickly? We've talked a little bit about the second point. But Ed, I know you have some insights on China. Give us your thoughts there and summarize for people who may have missed what happened.
Yeah, so what happened is the Chinese just reiterated policy. They said that, we want you to steer clear of crypto, be cautious. I'm sort of paraphrasing what they said. They weren't saying per se that we're going to ban your ability to mine crypto because, actually most of the mining is in China right now. But people took this to be a warning that there was a regulatory risk associated with crypto assets in China, and it just fueled the fire. The momentum was down, and so that precipitated a sort of what I would call a washing out move. That was the deep oversold levels that we got. And I don't ascribe any sort of long-term significance to the statement. I think it was just a catalyst for a washout. And now we've rebounded from that.
Yeah. It's so interesting. One of the phenomena that I've noticed from what happens when news comes out of China is that there tend to be a series of different reactions to it. And I think it's because US media has a very difficult time understanding the regulatory and policymaking framework in China. Obviously, these are statements that are released in Mandarin and not English. And what I saw yesterday was very interesting. Initially, the reaction was, oh my God, there's new guidance from Chinese regulators. This changes everything. And then the next phase was, nope, everybody calm down. This is just a recapitulation, a reiteration of earlier guidance. As it turns out, later in the day, it became clear that it was sort of somewhere in the middle. And let me read you this quote here. This is from Tom's Hardware, written by Michelle Earhart yesterday, because I think this is a very relevant point. Quote, the statement reiterates earlier bans from 2017 and 2013, but also addresses new services that were not mentioned previously. These include bans on accepting virtual currency as payment, as well as on offering exchange services between cryptocurrencies and more traditional currencies like the yuan and the US dollar. The statement also prohibits Chinese financial institutions from offering cryptocurrency savings on trust services, as well as prevents firms from using crypto as an investment target. Crypto exchanges, and this was your point, and initial coin offerings are both banned as well, although individuals can still continue to hold cryptocurrency. So mostly a reiteration, maybe a little bit of an expansion around the edges, which brings me to my question to you, because I know you've been watching it and thinking about it, which is the statement out of Treasury today.
Yeah, even before we get to the Treasury, I think that it's interesting to think about what happened there, because, they added a little more clarification and, expanded the remit of the areas that they wanted to think about. And I think there were two reasons for them to do that. One is because of the level of speculation. And so they're really trying to tamp down on speculation. We all know, as Rao was talking about yesterday, that a lot of the leverage within the crypto area is in Asia, and that's specifically within China. And so the authorities are concerned about people getting carried away, especially from a retail perspective, and that undermining any sort of regulatory bounce, if you will. And I think there's a second thing that no one really is talking about, which is the digital assets that the People's Bank of China, you know, the central banking digital currency that they're trying to implement. There's a huge push by the PBOC to get this started. The last thing that they want is competition from unregulated digital currencies. And so I think that this is a indication that when the time comes, when push comes to shove, if there's any sort of channel conflict, that they are going to come down hard on cryptocurrencies. So this is a shot across the bow from that perspective.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. The risk is that the Chinese official state central bank currency gets crowded out, and that's obviously not something they want. I guess a little bit of the acronym soup here. We have a CBDC from the PBOC called DCEP, which is the Digital Currency Electronic Payment System. A little bit silly, but obviously a very serious initiative over there. And I just wanted to add, because you know something that you said triggered in my mind. I wanted to read directly from the joint statement from the Chinese regulators yesterday, which was recently cryptocurrency prices have skyrocketed and plummeted, and speculative trading of cryptocurrency has rebounded, seriously infringing on the safety of people's property and disrupting the normal economic and financial order. You know, it's so interesting when we talk about foreign countries, and this isn't a comparison in any way, US or China, but it's interesting when we talk about foreign countries, we always sort of ascribe these like motives, like they're, you know, they're doing this and they're manipulating that, when, you know, their guidance, if you actually read the language, which is interesting, kind of sounds a great deal like guidance we hear from our own regulators, right?
Exactly. So I think that what's happening there, you know, Occam's razor says that they just told you that they don't like a whole bunch of speculation. I'm telling you some of that's because of leverage. And so they wanted to snuff that out. And we should believe that that is a primary reason that they issued their statement. And when you go then to the Treasury statement was that every crypto transfer larger than $10,000 needs to be reported to the IRS. I look at this as a similar sort of salvo to what the Chinese have done. What they're basically saying is that there is a lack of regulation in this market. On the one hand, we're concerned about it from a speculative perspective. But on the other hand, in the United States, we're also concerned about it from a taxation perspective. I think what's really behind the statement from the U.S. Treasury is that they want to make sure that all sorts of transactions that pass value from capital gains are seen by financial institutions, brokers, broker dealers, whether they are regulated by the U.S. Treasury or not, and so this is an attempt to put the crypto exchanges into the regulatory remit of the government, meaning that if you are the likes of Coinbase, hey, if people are making transactions over $10,000. The IRS wants to know about it.
Yeah. You know, this sort of reminds me, it's kind of what we were just talking about, the reiteration versus new guidance question. I mean, I think that it's interesting because at some level you have to think if you're an owner and operator of a business, you're the CFO of a small family firm, you have to think that these folks must know large dollar value transactions have to be reported to the IRS is not news to any CFO. Right. So it sort of seems as though it's a recapitulation, a reiteration, and a making even more clear and specific the guidance and the knowledge that was already out there.
Yes, it's a shot across the bow, basically, just like with the Chinese. What the U.S. Treasury is saying, by the way, if you're speculating or you're taking profits in crypto, as a lot of people are, because this is an asset class that has gone up, we want a piece of that. And the reason that we want a piece of it is because that's fair. We believe that they said, actually, at the same time, I had two tweets that came out in relatively short order that the U.S. Treasury, Biden's IRS, is taking a crackdown on the rich hiding income. They said that basically only 45% of transactions that aren't wages and salary are being recorded in a way that we're taxing. We're only getting a grab of 45%. So there's 55% of the actual income that's non-wage, non-salary, that's happening with the rich that we're not getting a piece of. And so this is part of a all-encompassing crackdown to make sure that the massive amounts of stimulus that are going through the government right now are paid for in part by taxation.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi: People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Yeah. And very well said. And by the way, to your point, talking about this shot across the bow, we also saw something from OCC talking about effectively reviewing all crypto related guidance issued over the past year. This coming from the new chief, Michael Hsu. This actually has an impact on specifically the three crypto firms that were granted federal banking charters: Anchorage, Protego, and Paxos. And for viewers of Real Vision, Anchorage and Paxos, we've had both of their CEOs on, Diego Monica, and of course, Chad Cascarilla from Paxos.
Yes. And, you know, as you were saying that, I was looking at what the IRS was saying about their general crackdown. Their statement said something about the IRS will be able to deploy this new information to better target enforcement activities, increasing scrutiny of wealthy evaders and decreasing the likelihood that fully compliant taxpayers will be subject to costly audits. So what are we to make of this just from a broader perspective? I think the first thing to remember, you know, when people talk about MMT and things of that nature, they have to understand that this isn't MMT at all. You know, people throw the term around. It's total bullshit when they say that, you know, now we're doing MMT. First of all, you don't do MMT. MMT is a framework. Secondly, MMT says that what you're supposed to do is allow the private sector to net save, that is the government to net dissave until you reach full employment. This is exactly the opposite of that, okay? What's happening is the Biden administration is saying that we don't believe in MMT. They're saying what we believe in is the fact that to a degree you can run deficits, but you can't run them ad infinitum. What we want to do is we want to spend, and we want to cover that spending in large part by taxation, which is the opposite of MMT. What they're definitely telling you, therefore, is, you know, for lack of a better word, tax and spend. And then the question is where do we get the money? And now they're giving you the mechanism for which they, for what they, how they get the money. And then the question becomes, is this net stimulative or not? how is this going to work out, you know, just from a GDP perspective? And I think that, you know, Keynesians, they would tell you that the marginal propensity to spend of the people that the Biden administration are going after, the richer, is lower than the marginal propensity to spend of the people that are getting tax cuts from the Biden administration, which are the working and the middle classes. And so as a result, even though this whole program is not, I repeat, not MMT, they believe that it will be stimulative just because of the marginal propensity to spend.
Yeah, from those taxpayers who are benefited from it. It's an excellent, excellent point. And let me just throw this one final thing out there as we talk about the Biden administration and the political framework that exists in. If we remember, I think it was back in December that Representative Maxine Waters, who is the chairwoman of the House Financial Services Committee, issued a letter, I believe, to the Biden administration saying that all OCC guidance on cryptocurrency during the Trump administration should be either reviewed or rescinded. So there is definitely a bit of a change, it seems, a sea change in the overall tone in the way that different parties here in the U.S. view cryptocurrency.
Yes. And, you know, just to go on to this whole concept of, you know, stimulus and whether or not it's going to have a positive impact into Q2 and the second half of the year, especially to the degree that we have a government which is constrained by political partisan infighting. So the question is whether or not we can get more stimulus or if we need more stimulus. I think that we have to remember that Nancy Pelosi, Joe Biden, the old people who run the Senate, people like Chuck Schumer, they're all old school Democrats. These are what I would consider, you know, what 30 years ago were called new Democrats. Those are the people who got religion about fiscal probity. And so what they're telling you is that we're not going to deficit spend. We're going to tax. And the question is where do we get those taxes from? And, you know, if the stimulus that we've injected into the economy thus far doesn't get us over the hump for Q3 and Q4, we're going to double down on more stimulus, but it's going to be funded by taxation. So I think from a policy perspective, this is what we have to get our heads around. This is what's coming down the pike. Potentially, that's negative for asset prices, because obviously, you know, the holders of assets are the ones who are going to get the hammer hit on the head.
Yeah, extremely important point. Whether you love it or you hate it, that's just the reality of the new administration that we find ourselves in and where Congress is at. Incredibly important point. I should say, and everyone knows that I'm just an unabashed Real Vision fanboy, but it's great to have these conversations with you. And one of the reasons why I enjoy doing these shows with you, Ed, is because I really believe that Real Vision is the only place anywhere right now covering cryptocurrency, digital assets as a macro asset class. And that's something that you just don't see. There's a lot of great macro coverage, obviously, in the world. There's some great crypto coverage in the world. But bringing them together, the kind of conversation that you and I are having, the kind of conversation I had with Raul yesterday, the conversation that Jack and Weston had, this idea of digital assets as a macro asset class, I think this is the future. I think we're ahead of the pack here.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, I was talking to Jeff Snyder about this earlier today, and he had some thoughts. We didn't explore completely that made me make some second guessing. I think what Jeff Snyder said, this is on the plus tier, we did an RV Live at 11. He basically said that when you look at what the central bank is doing in terms of expanding their balance sheet, they're creating asset swaps. What they're doing is they're saying there are these assets that are in the financial economy, in the private sector. We are going to swap those with newly created reserves. And therefore, in the private sector, instead of having those assets on their balance sheet, you know, whether they be mortgage-backed securities or treasury bonds, they're going to have reserves. People have been calling that printing money. Jeff Snyder, he takes umbrage at the concept that that's printing money. It's not. It's just an asset swap from his perspective. And the question, therefore, is, just from a crypto perspective, is the expansion of the monetary base, what impact does that have on currency debasement, on inflation, to the degree that it's just an asset swap? And his answer is it has none whatsoever. And what that means is that even though a lot of people are moving into crypto because they believe in currency debasement, they believe that currencies are being debased, they believe that we are getting inflation, actually, that's not what's happening. So I think that's an interesting point. And I largely agree with the point that he's making. It doesn't diminish from the value of the crypto space, but it does tell you that we're in a specific regime where the zeitgeist of crypto has a lot to do with currency debasement. But we were also in a currency regime in 2009 where everyone was saying that QE is hyperinflationary when it wasn't. Right. So this regime will be over, and then we'll just have to see what happens to this macro space when that regime ends.
Yeah, so well said. Boy, Jeff Snyder at Alhambra Investments, one of the smartest guys in the fixed income space in terms of his ability to break this down, look at the data. You know, Jeff Snyder, Ed Harrison, if that's not plus tier content, I don't know what is.
Yes. And, you know, by the way, I kept him for an hour, and then we had like a good 15 or 20 minutes of questions afterwards. And the questions kept on piling up. Even after we ended the talk, there were still more questions being asked. So he's a great person to talk to.
Yeah, definitely. I've had the pleasure of interviewing him. Just an incredibly deep thinker. Let's hit a few more of these questions. I know we've been running long almost every day we've been doing the show, but there's just so much to cover. The questions are so great, and we really want to engage. This one comes to us from TomTom, one of our regular viewers, and it's to you, Ed. What do you think of the CPI numbers, jobs numbers, and Fed thinking about tapering? Will it impact the crypto market later this year?
Yeah, you know, I don't have a firm view on the crypto side of things. Let me just run through my thinking and see if anything comes out of that.
Really, two questions there. It's the CPI numbers, the jobs numbers, and Fed thinking. And then what do you think about the crypto market impact? But really interested in the first part of that question.
Yeah. What I believe is that just going back to Jeff Snyder, his framing of the question, I think, makes a lot of sense. That is that from a mechanistic perspective, there is no direct transmission mechanism from central bank activity to inflation or to employment. So when the government gave the Fed a dual mandate, interest rates and inflation and employment, really, you know, the Fed's been making it up the whole time as to how they would be able to get there. Their big tool is interest rates, but interest rates really only affect the price of money. They affect the financial economy, and through a convoluted mechanism, you know, have an impact, but it's not a first order impact. So when we think about the CPI, when we think about the Fed and the CPI, it's complicated by that factor. But, you know, the Fed has its mandate. They're told to do something. And so they're going to do what they can. And what they've decided they're going to do is completely ignore inflation for the time being and focus on employment. And I think this is very important because they're really one of the only major central banks that has a dual mandate. Most other major central banks only care about inflation.
Yeah.
The Fed is telling you we're completely forgetting about the thing that central banks are told to do, and we're only going to focus on this other thing. And that other thing is short of a level by 7 or 8 million. So, you know, 7 or 8 million is a lot. A 1 million add of non-farm payrolls is a great number. How many months like that can we get going forward? Let's say we can get 3 or 4. Then we can have like 500 or 600,000. what that's telling you is that we don't get back to square one for a very long time, a year, 2 years, who knows? And so to me, that suggests that the Fed's ability to taper is limited. That's how I would put the whole thing.
Boy, that is just the ground zero core of everything that's happening right now on the macro side. Absolutely right. If you think about the ECB, obviously a single mandate, that's probably the influence of the German central bank with the fear of inflation being the primary motivator. And as you say, it's like the Fed has effectively forgotten the second part of the dual mandate, the part that central banks around the world focus on. But again, another point that you hit that really is right to the core, and not the kind of news that you hear on the news cycle, which is what happened today or yesterday, but the big picture that we try to do here at RVDB and at Real Vision more generally, this idea of paying attention to the stock variables and not just to the flow. You know, you get a good print, a number that looks good, that would look good by any other standard, but that low base effect being off 7 to 8 million jobs on non-farm payrolls, way below trend, such a crucial point.
Yeah, so I think that unless you don't believe the Fed, which much of the market doesn't, you've got to understand that their hands are tied. So either they go back on their guidance and they say, you know what, we were lying to you, or we're not going to see tapering for a long time. Then as for the actual numbers and where they're going to go, I have a strong suspicion that when you have 8 to 9 million people unemployed, I don't care whether they're getting STEMI checks or not, that's a huge output gap. And that tells you that inflation is not embedded. It tells you that you're getting a step level change. And then once the stimulus is out, the sugar high runs out, then you're still left with 8 to 9 million people, a massive gap. And to be honest, you don't get inflation in those scenarios. You need a mechanism to get me there. Please tell me what that mechanism is. I don't see it.
Yeah, such a good point. If I didn't have a job, I wouldn't be buying a new car, right? Just kind of common sense type stuff.
Here's and, you know, let me tell you, though, Gabrielle Hughes, who we work with, I asked her to take a look at some stories that were relevant to today. So that we could talk about them in the context of the market action. And one of the ones that she came up with is the fact that there are a lot of states that are about to cut those stimulus checks off. So to me, the fact that we're about to, we still have this gap, and then we're about to cut off stimulus checks for a wide swath of people, or even, you know, you can call it extra stimulus, that suggests that we're about to see, you know, how good this economy is without government largesse. I suspect it's not as good as a lot of people think.
And what will you be watching on your macroeconomic dashboard to make that determination whether that thesis is playing out? In other words, if this economy isn't as good as people think it is, what are you going to be looking at to tell you that's the case? What numbers?
I'm looking at jobless claims, and I'm looking at the jobs numbers. So I think the 200-some print that we had is too low. The million expected is not sustainable over the long term. It's going to be somewhere in between. Before we had this RVDB, I was going to look to see where we were at this point in the last cycle in terms of jobless claims, because there's a churning effect in the initial parts of the recovery from a deep recession. You know, we got to like 695,000 jobless claims on a weekly basis at the peak of the last cycle, and then we slowly trended down. We're now in the mid 400s now after, off the charts levels during the lockdown. 445,000, 444,000, I think that was the number. You know, that's pretty high, but if we aren't getting that much of a churning effect in terms of the economy, it should be enough to get us to 500,000 or 600,000 jobs per month. And I think that number comes down, the 450,000, the 440,000 comes down slowly into the 300s. So those are the numbers I'm looking for, those two numbers.
Yeah.
And by the way, let me just say that those are the two numbers that the Fed's looking at too, obviously, because if they're thinking about jobs, that's what they really care about.
Yeah. I mean, the most serious issue facing the economy, of course, is the number of people who have jobs. It's absolutely critical. And those numbers, it's easy to talk about them in an abstract way, but these are people's livelihoods and something that's just incredibly important to get right. And now, Ed.
Let me say, by the way, in a crass way, what if, let's just say that you're unemployed and you're looking for a job. And I think for a lot of unemployment checks, you have to show that you're looking for a job. You have to apply for jobs. You find some jobs and they're paying, and those jobs are like, $7.75 an hour, $10 an hour. And you have to put bread on the table. Is that, so are we going to cut people off so that they can go to those jobs so they can just barely make ends meet so we can go back to this whole secular stagnation economy that we used to have? I mean, that's basically what we're saying, right?
Yeah. And it's also the implicit, I guess, the flip side of that is the potential crowding out effect. If people are making more from the checks, why would you want to take a job as a rational economic actor when you could be earning more for your family and yourself by continuing to stay on unemployment benefits? It's an intractable problem.
Yeah, I mean, we're in a difficult situation. And I think that we're also at we're at an inflection point in terms of how we think about solutions. And I haven't seen any great solutions as yet.
Yeah. Yeah. A very sober issue. And now from the ridiculous to the sublime, Echoing Owl asks, what's Ash's and Ed's drink of choice as you watch your own crypto thesis unfold?
You know what? If we're gonna go to that question, Ash, I'm gonna tack on the question before I answer. I heard you talking to Tony Greer on Tuesday, and you were telling him you don't have a driver's license. You haven't had a driver's license in 5 years.
Yeah.
What is going on? Can you please explain this to me?
I am a creature of Manhattan, Ed. And listen, cabs, Uber, Lyft, Subway, buses. I'm a public transportation guy, man. It's easy to get around. And the only time you really need a car is when you want to leave Manhattan, right?
Yes.
And unfortunately, over the last 18 months, I have never wanted to leave Manhattan more, and I didn't have one. I just let it expire. I let it lapse. And then I called up one day or whatever, wrote them an email, and they were like, yeah, of course, but you got to come in and take the written test and the driving test. And I was like, you got to be kidding me. And I have been working, and I haven't had a chance to do it.
Wow, that is something. And so what do you, when you're drowning your sorrows about the fact that you have not had a license in years and you're going to fail your test to get a new one, what are you drinking?
It's always the white tea that I like am knocking back to stay focused and stay awake. And I'm not a big drinker, but when I do drink, it's beer. I'm a beer guy.
Yeah, I used to be a beer guy. I always was. But unfortunately, we were just talking about allergies. I have some sort of, it like stuffs me up. And so I've switched over to wine. I drink red wine now. I know it's boring. I'm going to get a lot of flack for this, but what can I do?
You were definitely a red wine guy, Ed.
I'm not, though. Yeah, I'm definitely a beer guy. But, what can I do?
I'm not buying it, man. I see you sniffing the bouquet and the cork and all that stuff. All right, Ed, here it is. The last one from Josh T. Is buying the Ash NFT a good plan for my retirement, or should I wait until the Ed version? Not financial advice, but never invest in anything that's an Ash NFT.
Well, I have the answer to that, Ash, because you haven't even thought about this. Okay, because Jack and I, we've thought about a SPAC. We call it the when everything collapses, we'll be there to pick up. That would be our SPAC. Your NFT is the cabinet that is missing from your background shot. You need to have a picture of you doing the Real Vision Daily Briefing with the cabinet in the background and sell that as an NFT. I think that's your NFT right there.
That was my mother's response too when we switched sets. She was like, what's the deal? Why are you missing? I'm like, it's like an artistic thing. It's a gap. And she was like, yeah, not buying it. Get yourself another gap. fill it in. Any final thoughts you have here on a more serious note as we come to the end? Because we've discussed a lot of important points on the crypto side, on the macro side, on the market side. Final thoughts, final takeaways to leave our viewers with.
Yeah, I think the most important thing that I heard Jeff Schneider say is, if you're thinking about a reflation on, reflation off toggle, which to a degree you are, if you're talking about the bond market, you know, the yields being a toggle, then he says that, you know, when you look at the data, you can sniff out a positioning instead of a completely, you know, digital zero or 100 on or off toggle. What we're looking for is we're looking for signs that there's reflation, acceleration, or that there's a deceleration that's coming. And there are ways to look at the data and to see that. I'm looking at it in terms of jobless claims, and I'm also looking at it in terms of jobs. But there are other data points that will tell us, you know, how good this economy is going to be when the full reopening is upon us. We just have to wait and see what those data are. But I believe that within the next 3 months, we will have an answer, and you need to be positioned by that time.
Yeah. Once again, Ed, we've run over time here. I think our original thinking was this was going to be a 30-minute show, but we keep running over time. And while we're having this conversation, let's throw it out to the viewers. Would you like this show to be like a 30-minute show, short and sweet? Or do you appreciate a little bit more in terms of the context? I haven't really made up my mind yet. I don't know if you have any thoughts, Ed.
Yeah, I just run with what the host, you're the host, what the host says, and I don't have any thoughts. But I do like the fact that you threw it out to the audience. I would like to know, you know, how tight do you want it to be? Is this tight right. enough? I think we went through a lot of different ideas. To me, it felt right, but I'd like to hear what you guys have to say.
Yeah, this show, we've really just engineered around what people want. And, you know, fortunately, we're not a network. We don't have the constraints that networks do. So we can kind of do whatever works best for the viewers. So it would be great to hear a little bit about what you guys think and what you guys would like to see in terms of Lent. So leave us some comments and let us know. With that said, thank you so much, Ed, for joining us.
Thanks, Billy Ray.
Thanks, Lewis. I always goof this. Thanks for watching, everyone. We really enjoyed it, and we enjoyed your questions and participation. Thanks again.